This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Merry Christmas. One of the new holiday films is an adaptation of Shakespeare's Othello, directed by Oliver Parker. It stars Lawrence Fishburne as Othello and Kenneth Branagh as Iago, the jealous ensign who destroys Othello by framing his innocent wife for adultery. Here's Branagh as Iago, meditating on the incomparable value of his reputation.
Good name in man and woman, dear my lord, is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse, steals trash, 'tis something, nothing, 'twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him, and makes me poor indeed.
Othello has already opened in New York and Los Angeles. It opens nationally December 29th. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have interviews with the film's two stars. I spoke with Kenneth Branagh about bringing Shakespeare to the screen in 1989 after the release of his film Henry V, which he directed and starred in. 5 years earlier, at the age of 23, he had been the youngest member of the Royal Shakespeare Company to star in Henry V. One of the advantages of a film adaptation of Shakespeare is the actors don't have to project to a large theater. They can speak in natural voices, which is what Branagh did in Henry V.
The thing that puts people off is when you've suddenly got declamatory acting and people doing things like they're from plays, and, you know, suddenly you've got two armies that sounds like they've come from Pluto or something. I can't bear that. It sends me to sleep. Because Shakespeare done badly is just about the worst thing in the world.
Now, the contradiction, though, is that film is a more naturalistic setting in a way than stage, because you can bring it on location. And although you could speak Shakespeare in a naturalistic voice, it's not naturalistic writing. Mm. So you have this kind of contradiction as soon as you bring Shakespeare to the screen and take it out of the stage setting.
It's a question of balance, you know. It is heightened speech. It is dramatic poetry, but if one can sort of vaguely say it in a way that sounds like he really is on a real cart talking to real people, and then you've got that extra dimension of heightened poetry, intensity of feeling, I think it really gives you that extra special thrill, and it's what makes it, in a sense, worth doing, is because it can somehow reach somewhere other. So you can just get that extra bit of juice, and it can move you in a way that a piece of music can move you. You know, it can get to the pit of your tummy quicker and somehow remain there, be more memorable. That was the great challenge for me, was to capture that extra special dimension without suddenly it becoming completely unbelievable.
Something else not naturalistic about Shakespeare: people don't speak to themselves in long soliloquies. Yeah. And that's something that's going to be especially self-conscious looking on screen, because, again, it's a more naturalistic medium. Tell us how you wanted to deal with that. And you're the one doing the soliloquies as Henry V.
Yeah, well, there are only a couple of moments, but one spectacularly long soliloquy, really, which does hold its own, because by that stage of the movie, really most of this reflective stuff that you're talking about, most of, if you like, the kind of Hamlet that's in Henry, happens a little later on in the movie when we've had a great deal of action and direct speech between characters. One of the things people liked was that Henry's soliloquies, particularly the Upon the King soliloquy, which is him basically trying to resolve with himself the fact that he's going to be isolated forever. I'm never going to have friends. No one's ever going to understand what it's like to have this kind of responsibility. I'm always going to be alone in the middle of the night, being a bit miserable. Well, we all, you know, at various times are alone in the middle of the night with our thoughts. He speaks them out loud, and it's a very, I think, easy to understand argument. And people, and this is what's unique about Shakespeare, I've said to me, it was really exciting because I understood it and I enjoyed understanding it. What, you know, you might think of as a complex argument, but which, spoken by a real person in a real situation, just came out. It kind of just, in the context of the play, that just justifies itself.
Upon the King, let us our lives, our souls, our debts, our careful wives, our children, and our sins lay on the King. We must bear all. Oh, hard condition. Twin born with greatness, subject to the breath of every fool. What infinite heart's ease must kings neglect that private men enjoy? And what have kings that privates have not too, save ceremony? And what art thou, thou idle ceremony? What drink'st thou oft instead of homage, sweet but poisoned flattery? Oh, be sick, great greatness, and bid thy ceremony give thee cure. Canst thou, when thou command'st the beggar's knee, command the health of it?
You have music behind the soliloquy. Why did you use music to underscore it?
Well, Shakespeare was an amazing manipulator of people's emotions. I don't think, you know, we do it very crudely, nor do we do it as super subtly as Shakespeare did it. But I just wanted to change moods and change atmospheres and to... you know, if you say that soliloquy was about a certain kind of introspection and, oh my God, I'm so alone, nobody loves me, then there's a music to be found there with some of the stirring stuff and some of the emotional stuff. I wanted to make the, again, because it was poetry, if you could find the music to match the size of it, then what you can produce in the audience is an even bigger experience. So you come out moved, you've been laughing, you've been crying, you know, but it's somehow, it's a big experience, and the music was really needed to enhance that.
Tell me about how you prepare to do a soliloquy, like the one we've been talking about, where Henry V is alone, thinking about how, about the responsibilities that weigh on a king that other mortals don't have to deal with, and the loneliness of bearing that responsibility. You're going to try to make it sound as naturalistic and as graspable as possible,
yeah.
And you're going to look for the music and the poetry,
yeah,
and to not make it sound like this speech that's going on, but that it's really being felt,
yes,
as it's being said. So what's your process of reading it and rehearsing it and delivering it?
The great thing about playing it this time around was that I had played the part on stage before with the Royal Shakespeare Company, so it was kind of in my blood. So I was, mm-hmm, I had a kind of ongoing dialogue myself with the character. Then you just look at the actual specifics of the situation. He starts delivering that speech when he is alone at night, the last hour or two before the battle, so it's everybody else is asleep, so you're going to deliver it more quietly, you're going to speak it more quietly. And what I wanted to convey was the impression of someone who just needed to say these things so much. He actually needed to say it out loud this long, and he needed to say it out loud because he didn't quite know what he thought. And so the soliloquy becomes something that is vital to say, but held in and has a certain tension because he doesn't want anybody else to hear. But it's as if it's the trick, if you like, is to make it so necessary, and then that gives the speech energy. And as an audience, if it works well, you're thinking, yes, that's it, go on, yeah, and then answer that question, and it becomes like a kind of puzzle that you have to solve.
Did you use a different kind of voice for your screen interpretation of Henry V than you did, say, in the soliloquy we've been talking about in the stage version?
Well, that's one of the crucial differences is that you just can use so much less voice, and I did. It's just a question of volume, really. I mean, if you have to, in a large theatre, to try and convey a thinking man, a reflective man, it's just very hard if you have to, you know, fill the theatre. And that was what was so wonderful about doing it on film. You could just say things like the last line he has, which basically says, "Oh my God, it's all in front of me. It's all or nothing on this day." And he says, "The day." What does he say? Oh, crap, I can't remember. Anyway, it's a short line. the day, my friends and all things stay for me, and everything's waiting. It's like, am I going to live? Are we going to win? Is everybody going to hate me? And, you know, you just had to fill a theatre with that when you were in the theatre. On film, you can take it right down and just deliver it more slowly so that you can convey the sense of, oh my God, that runs right through it.
Your Henry V has a very elaborate battle scene in it, in which the French and English battle in the French countryside, in the mud, on horseback, and there's volleys and volleys of arrows shot by the English at the French, and everybody shoots simultaneously. So there's hundreds of arrows that simultaneously go into the air, across the sky, into the French troops. This is your first movie. I think it was a pretty ambitious
scene for a first film. What gave you the most trouble in putting that battle scene, in choreographing the battle scene?
Well, the worst trouble actually was that because there was mud and there were hundreds and hundreds of people, that was making sure we didn't kill the same people twice, or, and also making sure that the French didn't kill the French and the English things. We used to get mixed up. I mean, there were so many people, so chaos. It was like being in a battle. Shooting it was like being in a battle. So we had major logistical problems like that. And also, I wanted to put it together piece by piece and build it up, you know, and start from the initial scrum of everyone being involved and pressurized, then breaking it down a bit and seeing some individuals and then seeing it gets rainier and rainier and things. So you had to do it all out of sequence and bits and stuff. So, I mean, half the time, one just had to keep saying, so he's killed him and then he goes and kills him and then have the arrows hit there? And so it was like a kind of... mad jigsaw puzzle, putting it all together. But it was doing it in little bits as well. And also, I wanted to make sure. Sometimes I've seen war films with great big wide shots of thousands of people in them and people not acting very well. Lots of extras who don't move like soldiers do in battles. They're always worried. They're looking around them. Their bodies are tense and everything. And I wanted to get in close and look at real actors, really... you know, appearing to fight, and so that one could see the frenzy that kind of hand-to-hand combat produced.
What did you have to worry about safety-wise when you were shooting the volleys of arrows into the air?
Just where they landed, basically, and also the major worry, the producer's major worry with me was being on a horse. Being the director and star, they were in trouble if I fell over, and they not only lost their director, they lost their leading actor. So they were very careful to... you know, ensure me left, right, and center. And they told me I must never rear up on the horse. And of course, there are several opportunities to do that. I mean, I was very keen not to do that, but I discovered there was so much noise around, and the horse would rear, because it was a marvelously trained horse, it would rear at a particular noise, like the clicking of fingers. But there were so many noises like that that I found that every time I was supposed to cut and get somebody else to rear, there would a noise would be made, and I would rear anyway. And this horse, this trained film horse, and much more experienced in films than I was, I can tell you, would rear up and be a complete star. Every time they heard, every time the horses would, I'd be on that horse, and it would be, you know, loafing about, its face, long in the face, and then the assistant director would go stand by, and the horse would suddenly the ears would pick up, and there's this... kind of great, kind of the Elizabeth Taylor of the equine world would suddenly appear to upstage the king. I'll never work with it again.
Kenneth Branagh recorded in 1989. He stars in the new film adaptation of Othello. We'll hear a more recent interview with Branagh after a break. This is Fresh Air. I spoke with Kenneth Branagh again in 1991 when he directed and starred in the movie Dead Again. Dead Again was a departure from the classics for Branagh. In Dead Again, Branagh played a contemporary Los Angeles detective. I asked him about the advice his voice coach gave him on speaking English like an American.
Well, I think a key thing was not to was to pay attention to the smaller words, like what, you know, instead of saying what, you'd say what. And lots of little abbreviated things like that. Not to gesture too much. I mean, I really did start very kind of, you know, overblown and kind of nasal and mad and completely non-understandable. And I literally had to travel my accent across the country. It was like getting on the accent train. And it went pretty much via Alabama and all sorts of places until... It really took time living in Los Angeles to hear. What we were trying to go for was a sort of neutral West Coast sound, which I think people fairly rightly think does not really constitute a distinctive accent in the same way as a Southern accent or a you know, Brooklyn accent. But in a sense, it makes it somehow more difficult to do because there are definite sounds, but they're subtle.
I think accent has always been... crucial for you, having grown up in Belfast. You had an accent when you started acting that would have been considered, I think, unacceptable for a classical actor in England.
Yeah, I mean, the Belfast accent is a very hard one. You know, that is quite, when people speak very quickly, it's very hard to understand because it's very nasal and very got very sharp edges. But it's one that I mean, I left Belfast when I was 9, so Although there were very formative years there, and indeed one feels very Irish, I moved to a part of England that was so suburban and wonderfully bland, actually, that it that after a while it produces the blanded, rounded tones you hear before you.
You write in your memoir that when you got to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England, that everybody around you sounded like they spoke on the BBC every day, and you felt like you were talking really differently, and you were very self-conscious.
Yeah, it's a very sort of fundamental thing, I think, one's identity as partly defined by the way one sounds. And of course, Britain still remains riddled by the notion of class, and as manifested in all sorts of conflicts between people from the provinces and people from the city and people from different income groups. One means of telling all that is the way people speak. So it's for everybody in England, I think it's an ongoing. One's very aware of it, and I guess in a sense it was very helpful to become an actor, because you are encouraged to produce a sort of neutral sound, a neutral accent, if you like, that helps you get work, because basically potential employers have so little imagination that if you walk in with a strong regional accent and you're perhaps auditioning for a part that requires, say, BBC English, they, on the whole, don't believe you can do it. If you walk in with a neutral accent and you're perhaps auditioning for a part with a regional accent, they tend to believe you can. And so the harsh employment realities of that meant that we all had to change a bit, and all the more sort of tight-arsed newsreader types had to calm it down a bit, and those of us with slightly more regional brogues had to even him up a bit. But eventually, you know, as an actor, I think it's quite useful to have a sort of rather anonymous voice in a way, so that, I mean, as for instance in Dead Again, one can then have great fun sounding completely different.
Now, you wrote in your memoir that voice teachers were particularly hard on you. Why?
Well, what happens when you, or at least what happened when I started at drama school, was there's a process of, I suppose you could loosely call it, breaking down in order to sort of build you up again. That is to say that they make you aware of every habitual physical misuse that you may indulge in. So if you have very bad posture, if you have stooped shoulders, if you have, as I had and have, a rather stiff jaw, if you're the arch in your back throws your stomach out and you don't rest your weight evenly on your feet, and if you have a lisp or you have funny teeth or you have anything that does not allow you to produce what was a favourite phrase of my voice teachers, which was rich, dark, golden brown sound. And if you couldn't produce rich, dark, golden brown sound, they'd let you know that you had a stiff jaw, that your tongue was too short, that you had dark L's, whatever they are. And it was all very technical and everything, and but very, in the end, very interesting. And, you know, we used to do inane exercises, sitting around with our the hands on our knees, all facing each other, doing whether the weather be hot or whether the weather be fine, or whether the weather be cold or whether the weather be ooja flip. Whatever the weather, will weather the weather, whether we like it or not. And I spent 7 terms doing this kind of stuff, with whether the weather coming from my stomach and going through my my dark L's, my short tongue, my stiff jaw, my thick neck, my rolling gait, and all the other. I mean, I left feeling like, you know, it was going to be Kenneth Quasimodo Branagh entering the acting profession, you know.
Not exactly a confidence-building exercise, is it?
No, it isn't, but it's it makes you aware. It makes you aware of certain limitations that you might put on yourself if you're not careful.
Well, do you think all that weather-the-weather stuff is part of the reason why you have such command over your voice, which I really think you do?
Well, it certainly has made one aware of, clarity. As an adolescent, partly because of not feeling one quite belonged where I was living, having come from Belfast and a large, extended, working-class family with lots of aunts and uncles and cousins and things, The sense of knowing exactly where one belonged was very strong. And when I was displaced from that particular environment, which many people are in all sorts of different ways all over the world, you often feel at a loss. And one of the things I think it does in adolescence particularly is it you attempt to hide by mumbling. So I spent a lot of my adolescence kind of talking like that, so that when people ask me things, I just say things like that, so that somehow I wouldn't be noticed. So drama school, in a sense, was a chance to re-educate myself and feeling and building that little more confidence, and then being given technical means by which one could express oneself more clearly and actually enjoy doing it. And then as one began to work on Shakespeare and some other classical texts, not only did you have some means by which you could express yourself clearly and technical equipment with which to do it, but you also had rather marvellous words which needed just that, because you can't mumble your way through a Shakespeare speech. You can't, without sufficient breath, do a big chunk of whatever, I don't know, Once More Unto the Breach or any of those things, or indeed convey any of the long, rather complicated thoughts that are sometimes in those plays without the technical equipment. But it was a... Drama school was a sort of a rather an awakening through those technical means of a certain part of my personality, which I think had been rather damped down by being displaced from the environment that I felt most comfortable in.
Kenneth Branagh, it was a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you.
Kenneth Branagh, recorded in 1991. He stars in the new film adaptation of Othello. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.